Chris Lazio alongside Sam Saig for episode 6 of Running the Option. Sam, how are you doing today?
You know, Dave, I'm actually a bit perplexed this week.
Okay.
You know, for the first time perplexed as we start the week, because we are about 6 days away from the first BCS rankings, and I'm wondering if we saw a precursor for what's to come in those rankings out of the coaches poll this week, where we saw a Wisconsin team that had a bye week leapfrog a Stanford team that handled Colorado pretty comfortably at home. And I was just curious, it's not so much that Wisconsin should or shouldn't be ranked ahead of Stanford, but it's the timing that has me wondering what's going on here. What do you think?
Yeah, you beat a team, a bad team, but it's a Pac-12 opponent by 41 points, and then you lose a spot. But I was thinking about it, and then I look, and I see that arguably the best win on Stanford's schedule right now is that at Arizona game, and we'll get to them a little later in the show. But they lose to Oregon State, so that is a big loss as far as strength of schedule is concerned. Well, meanwhile, Nebraska overcomes a 21-point deficit against Ohio State, makes that win that Wisconsin had over them look a little better. So I think this is strictly a strength of schedule type of thing. But should strength of schedule be more important than a team winning by 41?
I think strength of schedule, there's no question that Wisconsin has the best win of the two teams by a mile. The interesting thing to me is on October 1st, when Wisconsin beat Nebraska, they were ranked number 8 Nebraska at the time, and they beat them. That same day, Stanford beat UCLA. And yet, when that poll came out, Stanford was ranked ahead of Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin has a right to be ranked ahead of Stanford. I'm just wondering why it didn't
come then,
you know? But that's how college football works, and I'm sure the BCS rankings will give us plenty to think about.
And it could be the first of a couple of subtle moves like that, but we'll see in the coming weeks.
Yep.
But not a subtle move at all. The biggest news of the week, you look at TCU officially saying, forget you, Big East, we got a better invite, we are going to the Big 12. Well, just initial thoughts on this move for you.
Well, it's a big move, and for me, the initial thoughts are, I think of the old Southwest Conference, a conference that for so many young football fans, it's not something that you think about. But for a great many years, the Southwest Conference was really the lifeline of college football. The culture out of the Southwest Conference, the football that was played there, that was the blood that kind of fueled college football. And what you've seen now is TCU is going to be able to rekindle a lot of old rivalries from that conference, Texas, Texas Tech, Baylor. You know, TCU's a small private school of 8,000 students, and it's the first new member of the Big 12 since 1996, but it has a lot of football tradition and history in that old Southwest Conference, and for me as a fan of the history of the game, it's really good to see this move happen.
The vibe from the fans, and even the athletic director said it today, we're going home.
Yeah.
It's just a homecoming.
No question.
It's awesome, because TCU deserves it. TCU, for the last 5 years or so, has been a staple among the top 10, top 25 in college football, and they deserve this. And it's fascinating to me that on this podcast and throughout the nation, we were talking about the Big 12 dissolving.
Yep.
Just a couple of weeks ago. It feels like forever ago now, but this was just a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about teams like TCU and teams like Missouri and Kansas, where do they go when, not if, the Big 12 disperses. And now all of a sudden, not only is the Big 12 looking strong, but you could argue it's one of the best conferences in the country after the SEC.
No question. You know, this conference was at a turning point. And interim commissioner Chuck Nienas had a decision to make. What is the future going to be for the Big 12? Is there a future? And I think he went out and made the best possible move that he could have made. And TCU was obviously happy to be on board, because when you think about it, when that Southwest Conference I talk about, when that broke up, maybe the team that lost the most was TCU. I mean, when that conference broke up in 1996, since that time, TCU played in the WAC, they played in Conference USA, they played in the Mountain West, and now they're finally into the Big 12. And for both sides, what a move this was to get the league back to 10. They feel comfortable there. And I think that, like you said, we weren't even sure if this conference was going to exist. A lot was going wrong. Right now, I think they've salvaged what they could in as good a way as possible.
There are still whispers that Missouri could leave, and that's the big question mark right now. Is Missouri still going to perhaps go to the SEC? Are they going to leave? What's crazy to me is that I think that this new Big 12 with the addition of TCU could survive if Missouri leaves.
Yeah.
I won't have that same impending doom feeling that I had when Texas A&M left. Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Texas is down a little bit right now, but that's a huge program over the years. Texas Tech, I think, is on the rise with Tuberville. And then you add TCU, you've got these Baylor and Kansas State teams. There's so many good teams here, yeah. They could survive. And I think a 10th team would be happy to fill in Missouri's shoes if they did decide to leave.
I want to read a quote to you, and then I want to get your feelings on something you talked to me about earlier that I think could be a great selling point for why it's in Missouri's best interest not to leave.
Okay.
So the quote from Chuck Ninus, again, the interim Big 12 commissioner, he said, "We can't address the 10 versus 12 until we determine that Missouri is going to be one of the 10. There's no consensus at the present time between the conference members as to 10 or 12, meaning getting back to 12 teams.
Right.
And you were mentioning to me something about the BCS standings and the potential when they do come out for how they're going to favor Big 12 teams. And I was going to think, if Missouri pays attention to what you have researched, they may think, hey, this conference competitively may be our best option moving forward.
Yeah, what I was referring to was the fact that despite the fact that the Pac-12 and the Big Ten with their conference championship games are getting more love, perhaps nationally, the Big 12 is the conference right now, other than the SEC, that controls its own destiny.
Right.
Whoever survives that Alabama-LSU game, assuming some crazy things don't happen and one of those teams doesn't win the SEC, but that team obviously controls its own destiny. It's Oklahoma and Oklahoma State, I believe, that control their destiny over a Stanford in the Pac-12, over a Wisconsin in the Big Ten. So now Missouri, if they leave for the SEC, you have to win the SEC, which is a tall task to say the least. Well, if you stay in the Big 12, you could conceivably control your own destiny and have a more realistic path.
It speaks to not only the strength of the Big 12 at the top with Oklahoma and Oklahoma State and all those programs on the rise like you talked about, but also there is more of a balance of, hey, it's a tough conference, but it's not the SEC grind that we would put ourselves
into. Right, look
at
a team like Mississippi State.
Right.
Mississippi State is a perfect example of a team that you've spoken highly of on this program, that it's a good football team that's probably never going to be able to take the next step because there are just too many huge programs in the SEC. You could say similar about the Big 12, that there are obviously programs ahead of Missouri, but the path to a magical season is a lot more realistic in the Big 12. And this is obviously a football show, but from a basketball perspective, it makes more sense for Missouri to stay in the Big 12 too.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And again, these teams that are in the Big 12, if they stay intact and they include Missouri in that, and you stay at 10 and maybe you do add a couple of schools to round it out down the road. But as I look at what you're getting, if you're the Big 12 with TCU, yes, you're getting an old Southwest Conference team with perfect ties into so many parts of Texas coming from a huge metropolitan area like Dallas-Fort Worth, but you're also getting a rich football history, and you're getting players. If you look at the players in the history of this program, you go all the way back to Davey O'Brien, who the Davey O'Brien Award,
best quarterback is named after a TCU.
That's his namesake, right. He won the Heisman Trophy. You have Sammy Baugh back in the day. They've produced LaDainian Tomlinson, Andy Dalton now looking like a star in the NFL. I think that the Big 12 made a power move, in my opinion. It's not the biggest school, you know, and they've certainly had their struggles since leaving the Southwest and going to all these other conferences, the WAC, Conference USA. TCU's been to two straight BCS Bowls. They're coming off of a Rose Bowl win. Is there a better time to get them than now with a coach that I believe may be one of the best in the country?
It's such a perfect fit for both the school and the conference.
Right.
And I love that you bring up Gary Patterson, because when you look at this season you can very easily classify as a disappointment for TCU, considering the fact that obviously they wanted to run the table, they wanted to try and get into that BCS bust or national championship conversation. They already have two losses. It could be argued that it's a blessing in disguise, because for one offseason, there aren't going to be these rumors about Patterson leaving for greener pastures. Where are the greener pastures? You have a huge opportunity now in the Big 12. So he's no longer going to leave you for a BCS school, considering this is a BCS school. And while going to the Big East would have obviously been a move to the BCS, it's not quite the same thing. winning out in the Big East is not going to impress a whole lot of pollsters compared to winning out in a conference like the Big 12. So it's a huge opportunity for him. And with TCU losing two, maybe three games, I just think it's going to be great that that distraction isn't going to be there. And while TCU would certainly rather be undefeated and have all those distractions that come with it, I think it's going to be a blessing in disguise because I think this offseason is going to be 100% focused on the positives about moving back to the Big 12.
Yeah, and and Gary Patterson was already a good recruiter. I mean, he had this program moving towards another, maybe not this year, but another BCS berth was certainly in their future.
Right, there was
going to
be a bit of a rebuilding curve with Andy Dalton leaving, but the recruiting has been great.
Absolutely, and you know, what I look at now, to give him even more incentive, more opportunities, I think the cash flow will be even better for TCU, obviously, as the Big 12 starts to rework its television deal and so forth. I think that you're positioning TCU now as a big-time player moving forward in the Big 12, maybe not right away, but I don't see them as that far away from that upper echelon of Texas, Oklahoma
State.
I
don't either.
I really think they're capable of getting into that league and making some things happen right away.
And unlike a team like Utah that was a great acquisition for the Pac-12, that you kind of knew there would be some growing pains, I don't know that TCU is going to have those growing pains. I think this program right now is ready to play at a BCS level. I think next year they can be a two-loss team in the Big 12.
I do too, and you know, the Big 12's gain is obviously the Big East loss. It's worth mentioning really quickly that as Syracuse and Pitt depart, two of the stalwarts in that conference, if you're the Big East, you're saying, well, our momentum is still with TCU. At least we have a piece to the puzzle. Yeah, we've lost two of our best, but we've got TCU coming in. We can build off of them. To lose them now, it's pretty devastating for the Big East Conference to be stuck now at six.
Down to six teams. Do they expand at this point? And if they do, where does it leave them? I mean, does adding 4 to 6 teams from the Conference USA, from the Mountain West, really boost this team up? I know their dream team is UCF, but is this conference past the point of saving?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound glass half empty on this, but I look at this situation and I don't really see a great future in this for the Big East, because yes, they could go after those teams and it might be the smart thing to do. There are some quality up and rising programs when you talk about UCF and things like that, but just long term positioning yourself as a power conference and keeping your BCS status, I think it's a real uphill battle for the Big East moving forward.
It'll be interesting to see the moves that they make if it's about keeping the prestige of the basketball side of things together, or if they're really going to try and save the football side of things, because UCF is a good football team and we're about to get to them, but if that's the best you're going to do, if that's your dream team, your football program has issues. I think they might be past the point of saving. There has to be a casualty in all of these big moves that are going around, and the Big East is looking like it. The problem is, the Big East at 8 teams has already kind of been the forgotten team in the BCS. Everybody hates the fact that they get an automatic bowl bid because most of the time they don't deserve it. You've had some teams like West Virginia and Pitt have some big years out of the Big East, but for the most part, it's an automatic BCS bid that a lot of people hate. Yeah. And now you're down to 6 teams. That bowl bid is going to have to come into question. They're going to have to do something about that.
It is, and it doesn't help. You know, UConn going to the Fiesta Bowl, couldn't sell out their tickets, had to eat all of that money. It's a tough grind right now for the Big East, and it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward. So for our next topic, let's move down the East Coast a little south to something I'm going to call, for this topic, the state of college football in the state of Florida.
Fair enough.
And a peculiar and alarming thing is going on in the Sunshine State, because for the first time since December of 1982, so 29 years, no teams from the state of Florida are ranked in either the AP or the coaches' top 25 poll. And if you look at the AP poll, that ends a string of 472 straight polls that Florida State, and Miami, or really all three most years, have not been ranked. Let me just get your quick thoughts on that.
Well, I have to start with Florida State. I mean, Florida State coming into this year, 5th in the coaches' poll, 6th in the AP poll. This was supposed to be their year. I had my hesitations about that anyway. The schedule was stacked against them. EJ Manuel, for as great as a raw talent as he is, you had to question moving out of the Christian Ponder era if there were going to be some growing pains for Florida State. You lose the game at home to Oklahoma, that's fine. You lose the game on the road to Clemson. I'll give you a pass for that. Clemson looks legit this year. Last week, they lose to Wake Forest. And it's just inexcusable. We didn't just overrate this team. We were completely wrong. And I don't mean we as in you and me. I mean the whole friggin' country.
We all did. Yeah, the country did. And, you know, not once has this season has Florida State looked like the defending Atlantic Division champions. They haven't looked anything close to a top five team. And the truth is, when you look at this team, and I don't want to get on Jimbo Fisher too much here, but the truth is, this is an undisciplined team that lacks focus. No team in the country has been penalized more. They get penalized 9.4 times a game. Leadership's been a problem. Instead of defending their division title this year, right now they look precariously close to not even playing in the ACC at all competitively. And I just wonder what's happened, because they're ranked 112th in rushing offense, 114th in turnover margin, 100th in sacks allowed. Their best wins and their only wins are over Louisiana Monroe and Charleston Southern. I don't get it with them right now.
With Jimbo Fisher, it looked like such a great fit. It looked like a promising move forward, and they're reeling all of a sudden. And I'm not saying that their window is closing. I think they still have plenty of time to turn things around as a program. But Florida State, it's been years now. And Miami the same way. We'll get to them in a minute. But Florida State football has been on the decline for a decade or so now. And this was the year that they were supposed to start coming out of that. I mean, yes, they did win the Atlantic last year. But what was it, 3 or 4 losses?
Right.
It wasn't a dominant team.
Yeah.
But that should have been a stepping stone into a big year this year, if not the national championship year that some people were predicting. Certainly another ACC Atlantic title, and then you try and win the ACC this year. But they'd be lucky to get into the ACC title game at this point, and it could be a disaster season.
You just get the feeling with Florida State that game against Oklahoma, they put the entire offseason into it. And when they lost it the way that they did, it's like that was it for them, that their season ended after that game. You have to credit a program like Oregon, who also did the same offseason pumping up of their game with LSU. But when they lost it, they kept going and have rekindled some competitive spirit here. Florida State has tanked since then.
The logical next team to talk about is Florida, who came into the year near the bottom of the two polls. They were 23rd in the coaches and 22nd in the AP. They get off to a quick start this year, and people start whispering maybe this is the team in the SEC East over South Carolina, over Georgia. It's tough to punish them too harshly when you lose your starting quarterback, John Brantley, and you lose to the two toughest teams in the country back-to-back. Not many teams are going to survive that gauntlet. But it's the way they lose those two games. They lose 38-10 to Alabama. They lose 41-11 against LSU. They never had a chance. And we talked last week about how unimportant the quarterback is in the SEC.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that we shouldn't give them a pass for the fact that they didn't have John Brantley, but you have to have other options. You have to have a defense. And with a team like Florida that has a speedy supporting cast, you need somebody to lift the team up and persevere. They didn't show any fight at all, and that's the disappointing part for me.
I mean, you have to assume and hope that the Will Muschamp era will not feature this kind of discrepancy between what Florida does and what the elite teams in the SEC like Alabama and LSU do. I think Muschamp has everything you need as a head coach to get that program turned around. And to their defense, they are at least still receiving votes in some of the polls, unlike these other teams. But like you said, we didn't expect the gap between Florida and those two elite teams like Alabama and LSU to be that wide. We expected them to lose, maybe, but not to the degree that they did.
Right, because you know that Florida isn't at the level of Alabama and LSU. Nobody is.
Right.
Oklahoma
yeah.
could maybe have an argument, but nobody is. But Florida is supposed to be, I don't want to throw the word elite out there, but they're supposed to be a very strong program in the SEC, and two humiliating losses. Obviously, they still have time to turn their season around, but I'm not convinced they're going to beat Auburn all of a sudden, and it's crazy to even hear me say that.
Well, it really is, and the thing is, aside from a guy like Andre DeBose, who's a really nice playmaking receiver, I don't see this Florida team, with the quarterbacks that they now have in there, as being able to keep defenses honest. What you saw out of Alabama and LSU is they were able to press Demps and Rainey out of that tailback position because they could load the box and not fear the pass at all, and until that changes, it's going to be hard to see Florida win games the way we want to see them win.
Now, at least Florida State has the ACC Atlantic title under their belt. Miami doesn't have a whole lot to show at all in the last decade. Again, remarkable considering what they were at the turn of the decade back in 2000. They lose to Maryland in their opener, and then they put together that outstanding game against Ohio State. It was vintage Miami football. It was a suffocating defense. They only allowed just over 200 yards. Nothing in the passing game. I believe it was 34 yards in the passing game. Awesome 24-6 win there. And what do they do to follow that up? They lose at home to Kansas State, and then they lose last week against Virginia Tech, making that game, instead of a turning point, an anomaly.
Yeah.
And they just don't look that spectacular at all.
I mean, Miami entered the season, it's not pretty. They entered the season with a talk of a true death penalty, which no one wants to enter the season under that kind of speculation. And Al Golden, he walked into a mess at Miami. There's no good way to say it. He really did. The players for the Maryland game, there were 8 of them that were suspended. It was a terrible situation. But, you know, like you said, then they get Ohio State. We didn't know what Ohio State was going to be, but I still give them credit in that game for coming out and really showing, hey, we're going to get over the Maryland loss. This season is still going to have a huge upside to it if we can start to build from here. And for whatever reason, they got Stephen Morris at quarterback in there, but then they went away from him back to Ja'Cory Harris. It was kind of an abandonment move on the coaching staff's part.
A panic move.
A lot of people, yeah, it was a true panic move. A lot of people still haven't quite gotten why that happened the way it did. And you'd really have to wonder right now, is it the off-the-field stuff that's still affecting this team? Is it Al Golden not being the right fit for Miami? Is it the players not being as good as they are? Because with both Miami and Florida State, how many top 5 or top 10 recruiting classes in a row do these teams have to keep getting before we either say those players are overrated or they're not being developed properly, because it's not working right now.
The funny thing about Al Golden is it looked like such a great hire, and he did a great job at Temple. But when you look under the hood at his tenure at Temple, he didn't actually win anything.
Yeah.
And so you do have to wonder, is this the guy that's going to get Miami back to that elite level? I don't question that he can get them back to a competitive level, but can he get them to that elite level? Now, granted, they're already competitive, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The competitive for ACC titles. I'm not so sure, and these sanctions, we're probably not going to see a true death penalty, but we may see some things come down on Miami still that could hamper their development even more. It's going on a long time now since Miami's been really relevant in the college football scene.
It really is, and when you look at the Big Three in the state of Florida, it really is amazing that we're at this point, because in fairness to all three programs, they all feature first or second year head coaches. But to watch them all going through different struggles at the same time and not even able to get into that 20 to 25 range in the poll, it's something I didn't think I'd see. That's a state that, aside from Texas and California, you expect that state to be up there every year with talent producers. And right now, the talent may be there on paper, but it's not showing up on the field.
They're obviously not even close to the Big Three, but we should talk about South Florida and UCF, because here's a couple teams that appeared to be on the rise that now all of a sudden aren't. And what's nuts about the South Florida team, I don't think I've ever seen a bye week come at a worse time, because you get off to a great start to the season. You have that win over Notre Dame, which I think by the end of the year is going to look great, because Notre Dame has started to come around and I believe they're going to put together a solid season when it's all said and done. You have a Thursday night game against a Pitt team coming off of a very ugly game against Notre Dame. Both teams look terrible in that game. They lose that game. So South Florida, looking like they have a real good shot against Pitt, they lose 44-17. On Thursday, September 29th, they haven't played since. It's 16 days in between games. And it's just given us time to completely forget about South Florida. Because I think all teams are entitled to a dud game. It happens. South Florida, looking at their schedule, they could still have a great season. They could still compete for the Big East title. But they've given us so much time to forget about them, and our last memory of them, that ugly loss, terrible time for a bye week. If they came right back out and won a big game big, we might not be talking as poorly about them right now, but that's all we have to go on right now.
Yeah, and that, they were my preseason pick to win the Big East, and in many ways they still are. You know, when they beat Notre Dame, it was such a huge win for Skip Holtz. His father coached at Notre Dame, won a national championship there. To get that kind of win on that big of a stage, it couldn't have set up the conference schedule better. But right now you do have to wonder if they can keep it rolling. I mean, they certainly were humbled in that loss against Pitt.
UCF was 11-3 last year. They had the win over Georgia in the bowl game. They finished the season ranked in the top 25. And now we're talking about them potentially getting an invite to the Big East, so they could be a BCS team soon. And then they go and lose to Florida International. And then they lose to BYU this season. And now all of a sudden, the momentum that it looked like they were building last year in the Conference USA is all of a sudden lost.
Yep.
So, again, these two teams aren't going to be the reason why Florida football is in good shape, but if either of them were picking up the slack a little bit, it would help. And then Florida International wins that game over UCF, and then they lose to Louisiana Lafayette and Duke. So there goes that undefeated season and potentially getting into this talk too. So,
I mean, the state of Florida, it produces talent every year. It's too good of a football state to be down for long, but right now it's safe to say it really is down.
Florida Atlantic, 0-5, one of the most miserable teams in the country. They're saying, hey, nobody else in Florida is ranked. What do you guys have on us?
Sorry, Owls, sorry.
But Sam, you and I don't know at what point it became our identity here on Running the Option, but you and I love to kick coaches when they're down. And we had our segment a couple weeks back on hot seat coaches. One of the guys that wasn't featured in that segment, but seat has officially gone from warmish to vacant, Mike Stoops.
You know, Mike Stoops, and I want to caution viewers out there that are listening to us, we're not trying to hate on every coach. We just have taken,
only the bad ones.
Right, we really want to take up the mantle of a lot of coaches. The problem is for Mike Stoops, he's actually had some signature wins at Arizona. I mean, he's had upset bids over Oregon a couple of times. I remember him beating UCLA a few years ago when they were actually ranked in the top 10. That's how long he's been at Arizona.
I think this is really kind of you that you're starting this off with some positive vibes.
Let's
do that. Absolutely. Let's puff him up a little bit first.
You know, but the truth is, Saturday, he had a signature loss. And those sometimes are the ones that you can lose your job over. And that's what happened because a winless Oregon State team that really didn't have a prayer in most of its games was able to somehow rally its offense and defense enough to stop an Arizona offense that I still have respect for despite this putrid start to the season.
There's no way you can't, yeah. Nick Foles. I mean, Arizona is 117th in the country in scoring against, at 37.5 points per game against, which for a BCS school is just inexcusable. But you look at their schedule, and it's Oklahoma State, and it's Stanford, and it's Oregon, and it's USC, and you say, okay, it's a murderer's row of good offenses. Maybe we should give them a break here. Oregon State is 0-4. Their quarterback has 2 touchdowns and 5 interceptions on the year. They don't have a running game to speak of. They have Malcolm Agnew, the true freshman. He's injured in week 1. He's not available for the Arizona game. They don't have an offense to speak of.
Yeah.
So all those excuses go out the window. The defense is terrible.
It's amazing to me that a quarterback that's as good as Nick Foles, a first rounder in my opinion for sure, can be on a team that has found a way to fall this far in such a short period of time. And let's back up and give the Mike Stoops resume for a second, because he's in and now has finished in his 7.5 seasons in Arizona with a 41-50 record, 27-38 in conference games. And, you know, he ended a 10-year, a decade bowl drought in 2008 for Arizona. They went to 3 straight bowl games. Technically, that streak is still alive if something amazing happened. And for a moment there, the window was open for Arizona to join that company of USC, Oregon, and Stanford. Maybe not at that level, but right below it when they were at the height of their time in 2007, 2008, 2009. This Arizona program was really starting to roll. And then the wheels fell off this year, and you just have to look at Greg Byrne, the athletic director, and you have to say this probably was the right time, as controversial as it is to fire a coach in the middle of the season. If you're going to do it coming off of a loss like this one, which both of us agree was inexcusable, it shocked us to see that. I think that if you're going to fire him during the season, this is the week to do it.
It was their 10th straight loss against the BCS opponent. But what sucks for Stoops about that, all of those opponents were pretty darn good at the end of last year, and then at the beginning of this year, the only ones that weren't ranked were they lost to USC at the end of last year, and this year, of course, and then that ASU double overtime thriller last year that ASU ekes out. All the losses you can make an excuse for, but at some point there can't be an excuse for a competitive program. They have to win one of those games. But you make an excuse for all those losses, and then you get to this Oregon State game. And they have to win this game. I feel like if they just barely won this game, that would have left a sour taste in everybody's mouth. They needed to win this game big for the program to rally anything this season.
Yeah.
And they lose outright? Oh my goodness.
It's amazing. And now you have to look at the Arizona program and where they go from here. And the problem is, Greg Byrne, the athletic director, has got a difficult situation because Arizona's in the bottom half of Pac-12 schools in terms of what they pay coaches. They're going to pay Mike Stoops about $1.4 million a year, which is fine to attract a mid-tier coach. But if you want a mid- to upper-tier coach, that's not going to cut it. And the truth is, when you look at this search, and I appreciate what Byrne did because what he's trying to do is get on top of the coaching search early.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to fire Stoops now so that he can get ahead of what's going to be maybe a crowded field come season's end.
I love the firing. There's no way he's going to be your coach over the next 2 or 3 years. So like you said, this was the right time
to
do it.
So what are the realistic candidates for this Arizona program? This is not their basketball program. They pay coaches well. Sean Miller's doing great there. I'm sure they'll be in the Final Four soon. But for the football program, the names that I've heard surfacing, let's start with the unrealistic ones. I hate to say it, Wildcat fans, but Chris Peterson and Gary Patterson are not realistic options right now. Chris Peterson was in talks to be the coach at UCLA. I heard his name rumored for Stanford. If he's not going to take those jobs that pay, the Stanford job pays substantially more. The UCLA job is a more prestigious job. If he's not going to take those jobs, I don't see him taking the Arizona job.
And not even looking at it from a money perspective, it's hard to say this because Arizona, obviously a Pac-12 school, it's not an upgrade for Boise State or TCU.
No,
going to Arizona is not an upgrade, so I wouldn't even consider it a better situation. So if either of these guys are going to leave these schools, it's going to be for an improved situation or a big payday. They're not going to get either at Arizona.
Yeah. And you look at Mike Bilotti, he's another name that's come up, obviously familiar with the West Coast. He's a coach and an AD formerly at Oregon. Byrne knows him well, and he's a proven winner. I don't like the fit for him. I think he might return to coaching. I don't think it's going to be here. Mike Leach, to me, is the one name that if you want to get excited as a Wildcat fan, you can start to look his direction. There are a lot of things that fit about it. He popularized the air raid offense in 10 years at Texas Tech. That's a similar fit to what Arizona wants to do. It wouldn't be a controversial hire because the fan base in Arizona is more relaxed towards a hire like that. And besides, Mike Leach, really, we've talked about, he needs to clear his name. We think it's unjust, a lot of what's happened to him. I think Mike Leach wouldn't be huge on the money being an issue because he's just looking to get back into coaching. This could be the right job for him to come into if he wants it now.
And it's the right fit for Arizona to get their program back on track and back to a point where they can be competitive in the Pac-12 South, which I think it's going to be fairly easy to be competitive in the South because USC is going to pick things back up, ASU looking good, UCLA is a long way away, Colorado is a long way away, so it's going to be a competitive side to the Pac-12. Utah, of course, has a little time to go. I would love that hire for Arizona, and in fact, that's the hire that I think UCLA should make.
Right.
Of course, now Neuheisel might be saving his job here with a couple of these wins. I don't really know. I still have him on the hot seat, but that would speak to what you were just saying about getting ahead of this coaching search. If they make a hire like Mike Leach, that's strictly because they had the bravery to fire their coach midseason. So that would be a big hire, but it's really, as far as looking down the list of these guys, it's really the only hire that I could get excited about for Arizona. Any other guy, like you said, it's just going to be a middle-tier guy that's going to maybe get you back into a, or keep you at this going to a bowl every season level, but it's not going to get you to that competitive level.
The diehard fan base knows a name like Sonny Dykes, who was the offensive coordinator, really was the guy that orchestrated the Arizona rise in terms of offense over the last 5 years, but the problem is he left to go to Louisiana Tech as the head coach. Uncertain whether that would be a big enough splash to make an impact in the South, but that's another name that some Wildcats fans have thrown around.
So let's get into another guy that was shown the door this week, Stephen Garcia. For whatever reason, South Carolina has found a way into our show every week, and obviously we're not going to ignore a move this big, but once again, we have to talk about South Carolina, and namely, the guy that's prevented them, arguably, from being the team they could possibly be.
I will take responsibility for the South Carolina binge that we've been on, because I admittedly was very high on them to begin the season.
But I was right there with you. I can't make you take the fall on this alone.
I mean, we both saw what they had. We saw that Spurrier's been building this team for a while. He has had the recruiting classes in place for a season like this, where you have a tailback like Lattimore, you have Jadeveon Clowney, the most electrifying freshman in the country at defensive
end.
Up to the hype. You have Alshon Jeffrey on the outside. The pieces were in place. No one can say that they weren't. The problem is, when you get quarterback play that is this bad, it's not about SEC quarterback play like we've talked about, but when you're hurting your team by turning it over every game.
Right, we're not talking about a need for being spectacular. We're talking about a need for not turning the ball over and making terrible decisions on third downs when your team needs a short pass. Abysmal.
And that was on the field.
How does head ball coach have a blind spot at quarterback? We're talking about building this team up, which he has, and this looked like the year that they could make their move. How is the blind spot at quarterback?
I mean, the obvious answer for me, I have no idea how his kind of philosophy on quarterback play has gotten to this point, where you're talking about a guy in Stephen Garcia that Steve Spurrier wanted from the very start. He was a very hyped recruit. Spurrier brought him in, gave him every opportunity you can possibly give a kid.
He gave him a second, third, fourth, and fifth chance.
I mean, five suspensions now, and it's finally time to cut him. Here's the thing about Stephen Garcia that's so enigmatic to me. He's one of three quarterbacks in the history of South Carolina that throw for over 7,500 yards. His record isn't great, but he was 20-14 as a starter. His finest hour came not long ago, just last season, when they beat number one ranked Alabama 35-21, and he looked great in that game. That was one of his truly on games. But when you look at his overall career, that proverbial corner that you talk about a guy needing to turn, he just never turned it. He flashed it to you, but he never turned it. And Spurrier flirted with it the whole time. We're going to put him back in. We're going to give him another shot. How many times can a guy let you down? Apparently it's five before you're finally ready to let him go. It's just terrible timing for a program that had everything else in place to win this year.
We've talked a lot about the stubbornness of head coaches.
Yeah.
And maybe it is the fact that Spurrier felt like he needed a great quarterback, because if Garcia had turned that corner, he did show flashes, but even at his best, he was a feast or famine type of guy. And when he was on, he was a great quarterback, one of the best in the SEC, you could argue. Mm-hmm. Maybe Spurrier felt that he had to have that type of guy. He had to have a signature quarterback, because with the way this team is built, with arguably the best running back in the country in Marcus Lattimore, and with this incredible turnover-forcing defense, all they needed was a game manager at quarterback. And maybe it was stubbornness and trying to fit a guy in and make him the center of attention, as opposed to just letting this team be what it could be. Maybe that was the issue.
Yeah. And if you're a South Carolina fan, you better hope Connor Shaw doesn't go down. I'm not saying Connor Shaw's even the answer every week, but he's going to have to be, because if you look after him on that depth chart, there is not a player on that roster that has played a down at quarterback for South Carolina. If Connor Shaw goes down, every hope and dream that this team had, and they were plentiful, are going to die.
Georgia is starting to come around. We talked a little bit about that as a possibility when we were talking about Rick's hot seat. They could still take the SEC East. Florida's put themselves in a bit of a hole, but that's going to be a big game when that comes up. Connor Shaw needs to stay healthy, and he needs to do the things that Garcia wasn't doing and play smart football. There's a reason he lost the job in the first place. He was starting against East Carolina. He was terrible. Yeah. It's been a disastrous situation.
Last week was only Kentucky, but at least they started to move in the right direction. You have to hope it continues.
Moving into our quick hits, Sam, last week we spent some time on how unstoppable Georgia Tech's offense was. And then they had a little bit of trouble last week.
Well, you know, my biggest surprise of the week, in a win, was Georgia Tech's performance at home against a middle-of-the-road ACC team in Maryland. And the
certainly not a strong defense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say Maryland doesn't have their moments, but they're a middle-of-the-road team.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, last week what I saw was a Georgia Tech team that we're both high on, which is part of why this is my biggest surprise. We're so high on this team that even in a win, I can feel really disappointed in them. The final score was 21-16. The quarterback, Tevin Washington, who has looked brilliant to this point, turned in by far his worst performance of the season. He was 6-for-19, 114 yards, and an interception. And for me, that's not going to cut it in this offense, because for them to operate that triple option at the level they're going to win week in and week out, the passing yards have to be there, and the movement of the triple option off of that passing attack has to be there. And he just wasn't on his game, which doesn't bode well in the middle of the season at home against a middle-of-the-road team that you're going to have that kind of performance.
Do you think it's just an off game, or do you think maybe the beginning of the season might have been the
My gut tells me it is an off game. I can't really figure out why it was that big of an off game, because it was a really...
Especially at home.
Yeah. It was a close game. 21-16 gave a lot of those people, you know, a lot of fits in Atlanta. But, you know, I think that they will bounce back. I'm just curious as to whether there's now going to be a recipe on how to stop them if Maryland did something that teams can copy.
Georgia Tech just seems to be one of those teams that has to make it close.
Right.
And I guess the day that their defense steps up big, their offense decides to take the day off. I'm also taking a team that's coming off a winning effort as my biggest surprise. What happened to Texas A&M? I remember us talking about the Oklahoma State game. We were saying the difference there was Texas A&M's defense.
Yep.
And that Oklahoma State could find a way, but it was Texas A&M's defense. In the first half of that Oklahoma State game, Texas A&M imposed their will on defense. Now, granted, turnovers haven't helped Texas A&M on the offensive side of the ball. They've given the other team some field position in some of these games. But in the second half of the Oklahoma State game, they give up 27 points. They give up 42 points in the loss to Arkansas, another game that they had a lead that they gave up. And then last week, Texas Tech has a strong offense. They win the game, but they give up 40 points to Texas Tech. So they're averaging over 40 points a game since the second half of that Oklahoma State game. This is an athletic, physical defense, and all of a sudden, this doesn't look very much like an SEC team to me.
No, like you said, they just haven't been the same since that Oklahoma State second half, and it's really shown. And, you know, for me, I looked at this defense coming into the year as being a little bit behind Oklahoma, but I really thought they could be a top Big 12 defense.
And they were a top 10 team.
I mean, they were a top 10 team. They had a ton of talent returning. I thought they'd be pressuring everybody nonstop. I really thought that even in that Oklahoma State game, they were going to continue to do what they did in the first half and carry that on into Arkansas and so forth. I don't know if this, sometimes you see this where teams that are talented on paper, they have some kind of collapse in the second half of a game and they're not the same since.
Last year they were bipolar.
Right.
They had some great games on defense and offense, and then they had some terrible games. And I thought they could shake it this year, but they clearly haven't. Yep. And you would have liked to have seen them work this out as a Texas A&M fan before they get into the SEC schedule, because this sort of play just isn't going to cut it, as Arkansas clearly showed them, and that's not even an elite team in the SEC this year. So as far as the game I'm looking forward to this week, I think Oregon is going to beat ASU. I don't think ASU has a great shot of winning this game, but it is interesting to me that all of a sudden Arizona State has the offense to shoot out with this Oregon team. Because in years past, you had to rely on the defense to stop this Oregon offense, which is very difficult to do. And ASU has struggled tremendously against Oregon over the last couple of years. They have the offense to keep up with Oregon. If this game devolves into a shootout, ASU, despite their injuries, still has enough guys on defense. Perfect, of course, the leader of that. That can force some turnovers, that can make some big plays, that can make this game more interesting than the casual fan might expect it to be.
What's remarkable is last year's game in Tempe, Arizona State outgained Oregon by 200 yards. They had 600 yards of offense against Oregon, and Oregon only managed to get to 400. Not saying that that would obviously happen this time, especially
but
with the game.
They're a better offense
right,
than they were last
and
year.
And especially with the game being in Eugene, you have to love the Ducks in this one. But without LaMichael James, if he doesn't play, ASU has a tendency when they play power teams with the small defensive front and the lack of depth there to get pushed around a little bit. But when they play a speedy team, that's actually built towards ASU's advantage. If they're going to have any chance, they have to keep forcing turnovers like they have the last couple of weeks, and they've done a phenomenal job of that. If they can do that and get Brock Osweiler to play like he has at times this year, then they have a shootout or a puncher's chance, like you said. I don't think it's going to happen, but taking what happened last year and what you've seen at times this year, maybe.
And you can't discount how big LaMichael James' absence is going to be. Granted, Oregon has plenty of options in that backfield, but the guy has rushed for over 200 yards in three straight games. You can't just lose a guy like that and expect everything to be fine. Oregon's still going to put up their share of points, don't get me wrong, but there could be a big difference between 42 points and 56 points. This could be the game that it catches up to them. ASU is a two-touchdown underdog. Again, I don't think they're going to beat Oregon, but I hope this game is as interesting as I think it could be. I think this could be a right-down-to-the-finish last team to have the ball type of game. That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, for me, the other one that I want to be a last-second finish, and I think it can be, is that Michigan-Michigan State game that looks so great on paper. And the stat that sticks out to me in this series history is if you run the ball, you win this game. The winning team in this series has run the ball for more yards than the opposition 38 of the last 41 games in this series. So if you can get a running game going against one of these defenses and outgain the opponent, you have a chance. You know, this series has a lot of life right now to it, because for the first time since the 1960s, both teams enter this game ranked at the same time for the third time in a row, and that hasn't happened again since the 60s. To me, the winner of this game controls the Legends division, and on the surface, you have to look at Denard Robinson against that Michigan State defense. I'm a little worried for Denard this week. Last year, he turned the ball over three times, throwing three interceptions against Michigan State, and Denard Robinson has still turned the ball over. He's thrown 10 touchdowns, but 9 interceptions. I don't know at what point Brady Hoke and Al Borges, the offensive coordinator, are going to get things straight with him on the turnover battle, but if he does that this week, they're going to lose, I think.
Yeah, he's been getting away with these multiple turnover games because everything else is so electric, but this Michigan State defense isn't going to let him run wild. The problem is, I say that, but I just don't know if I believe it. Notre Dame's defense, I thought, could contain him, and they did. Yeah. For three quarters, they contained him, and then he just went nuts. The thing here, though, is that this game is in Michigan State. How much of that Notre Dame collapse was the Big House? We'll find out this week.
Yeah, and Michigan State comes in with the top-ranked defense in the nation, and they're playing in East Lansing. I think they're going to have a lot of momentum going into this game. They want to obviously end the undefeated streak here for Michigan. I think it comes down to Denard Robinson. I don't think his counterpart, Kirk Cousins, is going to turn the ball over. If Denard makes big plays, they have a chance, but if he turns it over, Michigan State could do what they did last year.
I think Michigan State wins this game.
So do
I've got Michigan State, and if they don't, and if Denard Robinson throws three interceptions and still gets 500 total yards, I'm done picking against Michigan. I'm just going to ride them all the way to the national championship. Forget Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. I'm taking Michigan. I don't know what to do with this team. I'm not saying I'd be shocked if they beat Michigan State, but I think the antics come to an end this week.
I think so, too.
But we'll find out.
Moving on to the upset alert for the week, and I look at this game that we have with Ohio State at Illinois, and this Illinois team, I've paid close attention to them this year, and they've looked great at times. I mean, like a top 10 team almost. But this is a program trying to turn the corner. And when you're a program trying to turn a corner, it's games like this that can get in your psyche. Because Illinois, in this series, in Champaign, has been outscored 227-92, and they dropped 8 in a row to Ohio State in Champaign. They haven't beat this team at home since 1991. They've lost 3 straight since they beat Ohio State when they were ranked number 1 on the road. But will Illinois be able to get out of their head these long streaks like the one they have against Ohio State? And finally, will Ron Zook's team win a game against an Ohio State team that is there for the taking? But will they be able to get that in their head?
Ohio State last week, they have the heartbreaking loss against Nebraska. But before they cough up that 21-point lead, They had a 21-point lead. Ohio State finally showed some really good things on offense. I'm sure the day of the loss and Sunday, Monday, they were feeling pretty down on themselves. But I think you come into practice this week and you realize, you know what? This offense isn't as hopeless as we thought it was. And Nebraska, for all their issues on defense, that's still one of the top offenses in the country. And when they get running, they're really hard to stop. Yep. Illinois, if they get down 14-17, I don't think they have the firepower. Yeah. I don't think they would be able to do what Nebraska did last week, and I think Ohio State would hold on for that win. The question is, can Ohio State repeat that performance on offense again?
You mentioned that Ohio State has a terrible offense coming in, 105th in the country, but they got a spark last week, albeit in a loss, with Braxton Miller, the freshman quarterback, who I think is going to play this week. He was injured, but I think he's going to be there. And he is a guy that can make some plays with his arm and his feet. If he can get this Ohio State offense rolling, I think they could take that one.
He had a good game against Colorado, and he's not a great passer yet. But you don't necessarily have to be. As Denard Robinson has shown us, I'm not comparing him to Denard Robinson, but he has that electrifying capability, and he can break the game open with his feet. So that is definitely a game Illinois needs to watch out for. And since 1991, I don't think they need to be reminded. Yeah. For me, this Thursday night, speaking of a team that can't beat another team,
right.
USC is heading into Cal, and USC has beaten Cal 7 straight times, dating back to 2003 was the last time that Cal won. This is the time that Cal needs to win this game, I think. Zach Maynard is having a great season, and this USC defense is vulnerable.
Yep.
We've talked about it already. This USC defense is vulnerable, especially against good passers. And Maynard is that, and at home, there's no reason that he shouldn't be comfortable. Have time to pass. I think he'll make some big plays. Jeff Tedford isn't on the hot seat, but at some point, he needs to win this game.
Yeah.
And this is a big spot in Cal's season, because if they lose this game, it's just looking like another 5-6 win type of season, which you may not have been expecting a whole lot more out of this year. But if they win this game, it would really spark the team to maybe put together a nice 7 or 8 win season. They're obviously not going to compete with Oregon and Stanford this year, but it could get them back on the right track and infuse a little bit of energy into this program. It wasn't so long ago that Cal was ranked in the top 10 and they were in that national championship conversation. They've fallen off quite a bit since then, but they can win this game. They have issues on defense, too, and USC is going to exploit those. And Robert Woods,
right.
Good luck covering him. And while USC is the deserved favorite even on the road, I think they're ripe for the picking here, and I think Cal can win this one.
It's been 7 years, and when you think about the amount of talent that Jeff Tedford has had at Cal in those 7 years, I mean, I was watching one last night on Monday Night Football, and Javad Best, who ran wild, Aaron Rodgers, you go down the list with Marshawn Lynch, amazing that they haven't found a way to get over the hump in this series. But I think with Keenan Allen, the wide receiver at Cal, you talk about a lot about Robert Woods, Keenan Allen's becoming a star for Cal. I think the firepower's there to shoot out with USC in this game, and I think it can be a shootout. The question is, when it's tight in the fourth quarter, if it is, will Cal be able to get over the hump? The fans are so hungry to get this win. I'm not sure if they're going to be able to do it. Maynard is still, he's great, but he's still learning. I want to say they can get the job done, especially at home, but in a series where they've had more talent than this and haven't been able to do it, I want to see it first.
It's also worth noting, granted, it was ASU and played at a neutral location. They probably beat USC, but that was USC's only road game of the season,
right.
And USC fell apart in the second half.
It's a great point.
And how much of that was atmosphere, I don't know, but Barkley looked uncomfortable at points. The bench looked demoralized at points, that maybe you don't have that in the Coliseum. And if this game ends up being a shootout and there's a turnover and Cal gets a momentum shifter, I don't know if USC will have the mental strength to overcome that. So good test for USC, too. Not one that they're going to get a ton of national acclaim for if they win, but they won this game 48-14 last year at the Coliseum, so they should win this game, but it could be a lot closer than that.
And I think it'll be a really entertaining game, too, for a Thursday night. I think it'll be a really fun game to watch.
So this has been Running the Option, Episode 6. Dave Consolazio alongside Sam Saig. If you have any questions or comments, as always, you can email me at VegasDavesDime@gmail.com.
And you can email me at SamSaig@gmail.com.
Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Take care, everybody.